How are sponsors viewing IPOs in the current trading market? What methods are they taking to structure successful public listings, both pre-money and post-money? And how are private equity funds managing to sell down their stakes after their company has taken to the stock exchange? We'll be talking about all of those things and more in this episode of the Merger Market Private Equity Podcast. Hello, listener. This is Rachel Lewis, Head of Auctions for Europe for Merger Market, standing in for Harriet Matthews. Today, I'm joined by some great internal expertise, Sam Kerr, Global ECM Editor at Ion Analytics. Now, the difficulty in exiting large cap companies over the past 2 years has perhaps been more stark in the equity capital markets than M&A, with IPO markets shutting for much of the past 2 years. Recent months have, however, seen a change, with a string of sponsor-backed companies going public, although some are still pulling listings relatively last minute. So with that, I'd like to welcome to the podcast our global ECM editor at Ion Analytics, Sam Kerr.
Thanks for having me, Rachel.
So as I said in the introduction, we're here kind of to talk about not only the ECM market broadly, but quite specifically how sponsors are operating in kind of what's largely been a very difficult past couple of years for ECM markets. So Sam, I really want to start off with the high level picture. How are sponsors taken to IPO markets at the moment, particularly when it comes to the different size brackets?
So I think that's a very interesting question. And I think what we've certainly seen this year is a real market of haves and have-nots. And I think we've really seen that at a global level, particularly in reference to the United States and Europe. What we're certainly seeing from investors is a real sort of bias towards larger cap assets. And I think what we've seen on the mid-cap space is companies really struggling to go public if they're not deemed big enough. So for sponsors that have large cap assets, and I would say the best example of this in Europe has been Galderma, which was the most successful IPO so far this year, they have been very popular. And investors have really embraced the sell down processes in these assets. I think another very interesting example actually is if you look at CVC, they listed two portfolio companies so far this year, Zabka Group and Douglas, both on the slightly smaller side. Certainly not small by any metrics, but more mid-cap style assets. And both companies have somewhat struggled a little bit. Douglas down a lot from its IPO price, and Zabka has dipped below, while the parent itself also did an IPO in Amsterdam and is, of course, a very large cap asset and has been incredibly successful and one that investors have really loved. So I think that at the moment is where we're sitting in terms of the bias on the size portfolio, and I think it's going to continue.
That's really interesting, actually, because when I'm talking to sponsors and advisors around about, you know, what sponsors are acquiring at the moment, it is typically more in that mid-cap bracket. We've noticed a lot of, especially kind of in the large cap and the upper mid-market sponsors, drop down size deal segments a little bit. And that reason is, well, there's a couple of reasons. The first is because it's easier to grow. Everyone's talking about value creation in this day and age, but also because the exit optionality. But I'm not sure if there's a little bit of a kind of weird system at play here, because you're saying that large assets have been successful, but this is where sponsors have struggled to sell in M&A markets over the past couple of years. So it's interesting you say that the large ones are perhaps the most interesting.
Yeah, so I think actually at the certain points, a company almost becomes too big to sell and you can't get other sponsors engaged. They can't put the packages together to buy them, and there aren't the strategic bidders out there to do it either. So you have to go public. And that, of course, is a far harder process, right? You're dealing with equity market volatility. You're dealing with the general flow of the IPO market, which, you know, is fairly tempestuous. So I think that's the way sponsors are going to have to start thinking about these large cap assets, is they're going to have to bin some of the sale processes and start getting them on an IPO track, which is going to take longer. Certainly, if you're looking at a complete exit, you're looking at IPO and subsequent sell downs afterwards. But in the long term, I feel that might be their only option.
I think this is quite interesting for one of the other things I wanted to talk about, actually. which is companies coming back from failed sale processes in order to go public. We've seen two this week, one particularly large one, which is Stada, large cap process we follow very closely. And then, you know, a little bit on the smaller end as well, Asker Healthcare, which is a Nordics-based asset owned by Nalco. They had sale processes that didn't materialize and have now appointed banks for IPO. Do you think... you know, public markets investors, do they require a different equity story? Does it matter to them that there's been a failed sale?
I think it matters to them to the extent that they're not going to outpay a strategic for an investor, because another sponsor or a strategic investor can certainly utilize synergies far better than the public markets can. But what I think certainly public markets are happy to look at is any company where they're going to have a degree of liquidity. And so I think... with the cases of Stada particularly, I think you had a situation where they just couldn't get a package together at the valuation that was required for the sale. So the sponsor had to go to the IPO market. Now, if we look at Asker, Asker's by no means small. You know, it's $1 billion+ revenue. So you're getting into the stage now where you're looking at something where an IPO is possible at that level. I mean, the mad thing is, and because it is mad, because the European market used to be almost totally mid-caps of the IPO, is $1 billion+ revenue probably is the smallest you can be now to do a successful IPO, certainly in the markets we're seeing at the moment. So I think on that front, you can bring a failed asset to the IPO market, but you do have to be a lot more generous on the valuation. Now, that's not a major problem, I don't think, because it is a staged sell down process, right? If you look at the strategy of EQT and Galderma, again, as I was talking about earlier this year, they didn't sell it at a very high price. It was a colossal discount to its closest peer, which was L'Oreal. But then 6 months later, they did a fantastically accretive sell down through a block trade. So on that front, as long as you have a longer term horizon, you can do a very successful IPO at a decent valuation and then sell down more at a better one later.
I want to talk about sell downs and how we structure IPOs later, but just kind of a couple more questions on the pipeline at first. You know, we've talked about the role of the sponsor almost as this, you know, you buy a mid-cap company and then you list it as a sponsor. But how does the universe fare for a family-owned companies? Does this mean that you naturally might need a sponsor before going public, and we're likely to see fewer family-backed IPOs? And also tech stocks. So, you know, I think Vinted looks to be the new darling perhaps of the tech scene a little bit. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, so I think on tech first, we need a more VC-style market in Europe. That's without question. With all the talk that's going on about the London Stock Exchange at the moment, and it's a perennial debate that we have in London, what can be done to increase, to sort of reignite the AIM market or something like that? I just don't think that's going to happen. And I think what you actually need to create in places like London and also elsewhere through Europe is a far more venture-style investor base, which is willing to take early bets on companies and get them large enough to the scale where they can go public on their main markets. Now, with the question on family-owned companies and any smaller business, yes, I think naturally you are going to have to engage with sponsors at some point. I think the idea, the days of just a family-owned business being public and being able to go public straight away, unless you are significantly large, is probably very difficult at the moment.
So you see a much kind of closer relationship between sponsors and ECM markets?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think, again, I keep citing EQT, but if you look at sort of their strategy, what they do very well is taking companies from a mid-cap base and getting them large enough to go public and then listing them at valuations the market wants to buy them. Now, if you saw what happened with Flix this year, you know, the German bus company, that has been on the IPO pipeline for 2 or 3 years. They have now stepped away from that and brought in EQT as a significant minority investor to get them to the level where they can go public. And that, I think, is a strategy that a lot of people are going to be employing. So I think that might mean more sponsor investment at a minority level, because a lot of companies won't want to give up that control.
This brings me on nicely to kind of the next topic that I wanted to talk about, is how to structure and work on a successful IPO in this environment, because this kind of pre-IPO private placement is something we've seen happen increasingly. What's the reason behind that?
I think the reason we're seeing an increase in pre-IPO placements is companies need a longer runway. So if you need to raise capital in IPO, IPO markets are difficult. You need to grow to a point where you're larger to IPO. The only place you can go is a pre-IPO funding round. And I think sponsors have been quite attuned to this, getting involved and putting in some equity growth capital in order to get IPO candidates up to the point where they can list.
And I think this is where we've seen a lot of the sovereign wealth funds and the institutional investors play as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. The sovereigns are acting as sponsors now in that. I mean, and they probably were a bit further ahead actually than the sort of typical sponsor market at looking at them, at seeking these strategic minority investments at a company that will be going public, but going public a few years down the line.
And does this have anything to play in the role of leverage? I know it's quite common that the companies need to deleverage either pre or post money and the IPO. How's that all play in it?
I think you really need to deleverage pre money now. I think investors still don't look fondly on a company using an IPO to pay off its debt. So I think you do need to get to a stage now where you're willing to get investors involved early to get the company's leverage position into a place where it can IPO. If you look at the differences between Douglas and Galderma, that really was a big part of it. Douglas was using its IPO to delever. Galderma delevered before IPO in a pre-IPO placement. And I think that's going to be something we see a lot more of, using sort of sponsor investors, sovereign wealth funds to come into that cap structure to get a company IPO ready. You really cannot be over-levered now at IPO.
Okay. And I think, you know, part of all of this as well is the valuation dynamic, which you mentioned in Galderma. Sold it at a massive discount. But one particular thing I noticed in the few really successful IPOs we've seen this year is there's actually been kind of a very small secondary offering and a huge, huge primary issuance instead.
Yes. I think if you've got the primary for growth, I think investors are very happy to get on board with that. Now, what we've started to see more also is a small secondary offering in a short lockup period. So traditionally, an IPO investor, or sorry, a pre-IPO investor like a sponsor would be locked up for a year. Now, in the case of Galderma and other listings, we've seen a 6-month lockup period because the sponsor has been doing such a small secondary sell down. I think investors are far more comfortable with that now than we've seen in the past. So I think that's a model now for sponsors to use, is sell the IPO at the discount, let the company prove itself in its results, and then do your first significant sell down through a follow on later on.
And how are sell downs doing at the moment?
Pretty good. I mean, the sell down market in Europe has been amazing, actually, for the last 2 years. Certainly a dynamic I have really never seen until sort of the start of 2022-23 was these multi-billion sell downs that are taking place in the course of a single evening. I mean, although it wasn't a sponsor IPO, if you look at, for example, the London Stock Exchange Group sell downs, which was primarily led by Blackstone, you know, they were being able to do billions over the course of a single night. The liquidity in Europe is there for these large sell downs, but you just have to be liquid enough and large enough.
Do you think that because I think there has been this kind of contrast in sell down activity and IPO activity,
and what's
driving that?
There's always been a more fruitful market, I think, and the banks hate that because they get paid less to do them. But the reason behind it is investors value liquidity so much, and if you think about an IPO, you have really no liquidity in that stock. I mean, if you're looking at an IPO investment, you're there as a shareholder. Certainly if you're an institutional investor taking a significant stake. A sell down, you're normally only really talking about a few days of trading at any point during a sell, when you're investing in a sell down. So if it goes wrong, you can trade out of it. Even if it goes well and you want to monetize your stock, you can trade out of it. Liquidity is something that is valued perhaps more now than it has ever been. And the reason behind that actually was the failure of the IPO market in 2021. With long-only investors being stuck in, you know, these high-growth tech companies that suddenly traded down and unable to trade out. So that's why sell-downs will continue to be a very favorable asset class for investors. It just gives them the liquidity profile where they can monetize or trade out if it goes wrong.
It's interesting as well, because I think there are still a lot of companies that went public, let's call it 2019, 2020, beginning of 21, which are now trading underwater, but sponsors still hold.
Yes, absolutely.
Huge amount of the share capital.
Yeah. You have investors who are stuck in it from the IPO and the sponsor seller stuck in it from the IPO. So it's a sort of the ultimate lose-lose, isn't it? I think that is going to be a situation where we are going to start to see more of those being retaken private, often by the sponsor that tried to list it in the first place.
Yeah, we saw that with Synlab.
Yeah, exactly. The great Synlab example. But I think there is a market acceptance now that that's going to happen. It's not a great look for a sponsor to list something and then buy it back super cheap when it trades down, but, you know, needs must.
And then it comes back to the question of how can you exit a large cap company, which is this whole cycle of M&A that we all work in. So,
and I think if you want a case study Galderma is a great case study, and even what CVC has done with its own with itself in Amsterdam is a great case study of how you can start a partial exit of a large cap company. It is going to be partial. It takes a long time to get out of these assets. They are huge. But if you take that approach of listing something at a valuation that the market finds very favorable and are willing to take a slightly longer term process on the thought process on the exit, then I think you can exit these companies pretty successfully. I think trying to get a single price from another sponsor or from a strategic at the moment is incredibly difficult. And I think it will remain so while interest rates are where they are.
And that valuation discount is actually interesting, because then it has a knock-on effect onto private market valuations. Yes. Because of the comparables.
Absolutely.
And the comparison.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're talking, I would say, minimum 30% discount to listed peers. And if you're not coming at that valuation, you need to have a hell of a good equity story to justify it. Anything below 20% and it's deemed expensive, which is a very new dynamic for the European IPO market and really for the global IPO market, because it used to be an IPO discount was 10%. That's not the case anymore. It hasn't been the case for a couple of years. If you're still thinking like that, then you're not going to be able to list your company.
And just on that topic of sell down, you wrote quite an interesting article this week about sponsor returns in IPO markets. Talk me through that.
So sponsors, a lot of their success in the IPO market is due to their reputation. So again, people are going to think this is an advert for EQT, but EQT again is one that has done very, very well. If you look at the IPO of Galderma this year, it's been a hugely cash generative thing for investors. And that meant when EQT came back later on to sell more, investors were very happy to take it because they've already made a lot of money on the stock and they trust the sponsors to do the right thing. If you're a sponsor that developed a reputation for being a bad seller, and I'm not going to name names here, but it's going to be a big struggle to do an IPO. A couple of years of bad IPOs trading underwater, done at prices which didn't really work for the market, is going to lead to investors wanting a discount just for the sponsor itself, then on top of the IPO discount appears.
Okay, so just going to round out the podcast with a forward-looking view. We've just sat a few days after the US election.
Yeah.
What impact do you think that might have on ECM markets?
So at the moment, we're reading tea leaves, aren't we, on the US election. How extreme is the new Trump administration going to be when it comes to tariffs? Where are the growth pockets in equity markets? I think we're going to be reading these tea leaves for a while, but there are certain trends which I think are pretty inescapable. European defense is going to be a very, very hot sector going forward. We are going to have a more isolationist president, one who is certainly publicly nowhere near as committed to NATO as any of his predecessors. The possibility of a Russian success in Ukraine, as bleak as that sounds, also is something that has to be on the mind of European governments at the moment, and they need to start spending money. They will probably be buying mostly from European defense companies, Airbus, Safran. There was a very successful IPO this year, Renk, which was actually a mid-cap, but a mid-cap in the right sector because it was serving the defense industry. So that immediately is something that I think is going to be a very hot place for Europe. Big tech is going to do very well globally. If you look at the Trump administration, Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, all the people that are connected to the Trump administration now, they are all tech advocates. I would see big tech deregulation in the States, which will then filter globally because it's a competitive market, right? You don't want to be regulating tech when the US isn't, which I think is going to lead to a lot of tech growth. Now, that is going to possibly lead to situations where we have bubbles formulating and everything else, but certainly tech is going to be back, I think, under Trump. And banking is going to be pretty successful, I think. If they do bank deregulation, and that seems to be what equity markets are pointing to at the moment, big US banks are going to have a few very good years ahead of them. Whether we start to see pre-crisis style risk-taking again, well, hope not, but that is something that seems to be on the card of most investors. I think for sponsors, what is going to be interesting is it's going to lead, however, to pockets of serious underperformance in the equity markets. Anywhere you have a sort of retail company, for example, with a large export market to the United States, that's going to be fundamentally more unattractive if Trump puts in tariffs. If you have a sponsor that has a longer investment timeline, they can probably take that for a little bit and sort of grow it in areas where it can make money, where perhaps that company would be unable to IPO at the moment.
Okay, and what does this mean for Europe listings versus US listings?
The great debate. It's a difficult one. I think the success of a US listing is always very good for a company that has the size profile to make it work. And I'm saying with IPOs anyway, you need to be large. You need to be super large to list in the US. you need to be something like Arm to make it work. If you're not of that size and scale, I think a European listing is still pretty attractive. I think one of the benefits of a European listing does remain that you will have investors who know you, who have really sat through your fundraising process. And I don't think you can really replicate that with the amount of liquidity in the US. There is a great track record of European companies listing in the States and becoming orphan stocks. And I think if you don't have the real size and profile to command a huge amount of investor attention there, I think it's a bad place to list.
Okay, I think that's a good point to end on. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening at home or on the tube, wherever you are. And thank you very much for Sam for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me. Let's do it again soon.
If you like the podcast, please don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Thank you very much again. Goodbye, everyone.